Hey there, web or podcast listeners. I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited to make it a little bit shorter and a little bit sweeter. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Lawmakers returned to Montpelier this week for the 2018 legislative session. And on the second day of the session, Governor Phil Scott delivered his State of the State address. He said Vermont is facing a major demographic crisis. Population trends show that a number of young workers are leaving the state, and the governor says this will lead to catastrophic results if it's not reversed.
We have 23,000 fewer people under the age of 20 than we did in the year 2000. We now have nearly 30,000 more over the age of 65 than we did in that same year. There are 30,000 fewer people between the ages of 25 and 45 than we had 10 years ago. Ours is the second oldest population in the country. If we do nothing, we'll soon be number one. This has got to stop. It's simply unsustainable.
Scott also pledged to oppose any effort to raise taxes this year for any purpose. What will be the key issues of the session? Today on the program, I'm joined by some of Vermont's best political reporters to discuss the people and issues of the 2018 session. With us are Alicia Friess of 7 Days, April McCollum of the Burlington Free Press, and Neil Goswami of WCAX-TV. Great to have you all here.
Good to be here. Bob.
Thanks, Bob.
You can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. What do you think the top issues are of this session? What kind of issues would you like to see lawmakers deal with during the 2018 session? Let's just start with the governor's speech and get your general reaction to it. Alicia, what are your thoughts about the governor's State of the State address yesterday?
Well, on the surface, there was nothing shocking. I think in large part he was reiterating a platform that he's already made quite clear. There was definitely a really strong emphasis on his insistence that there should be no new taxes or fees. And he made an important clarification that, in his view, that extends to the property tax. And he didn't say exactly how he's going to propose that the state avoid a projected 7% increase in property taxes. But I think that could that will have to lead to some, a pretty dramatic proposal on his part that we'll get more information about later.
April?
Yeah, I agree. I don't think that there was a lot that was particularly new. He did throw out a few ideas that he has raised in some form in the past. He mentioned a program to offer free tuition to National Guard members, and some other ideas that have come up in the past that it seems like he's going to emphasize more this year as part of that economic development agenda. But I agree with Alicia. I think a lot of it was stuff that he's already talked about. And really, in this case, the controversy is going to be when the details come out in the budget address.
Neil?
Yeah, I think the governor's really hit his stride in defining what the state's challenges are and the scope of those challenges. I think he's really raised the bar in terms of expectations for his budget address, where we've got a $40 to $50 million budget gap already. He's at least so far pitched several millions of dollars in new spending or new costs because of eliminating revenue. So really, the governor has to deliver in 2.5 weeks in his budget address a plan that balances the budget without raising taxes or fees as he's promised. And if he falls short, I think a lot of people are going to be really disappointed in a governor who is able to really describe the problems but unable to tackle them.
Well, one of the governor's overarching themes yesterday is that he believes Vermont will be in very bad financial shape if more younger workers and their families don't move here. And he says he plans to target young workers in other states in an effort to entice them to relocate to Vermont.
I'll propose a bold, sophisticated campaign to identify and persuade working-age individuals, families, and entrepreneurs to relocate to Vermont. This program will use state-of-the-art targeting plus direct outreach to individuals and businesses to increase the number of workers. And with a self-sustaining funding model with measurable results, the return on investment will be tracked and reported to me and to the legislature.
Alicia, my guess is if we look back on most state of the state addresses in the past decade, we'd see the governors address this issue of population concerns. There's not an easy answer to this. Do you think, do we have any sense of Governor Scott's plan being different than what's been tried before?
I think there's a lot of skepticism that he will be able to succeed where past governors have failed. You're right that this is not a new idea, and it's easy to see why it's a tempting endeavor. But I think past experiences have shown that it's easy to spend a lot of money trying to entice people to move to Vermont, and difficult to get results. So I know lawmakers are very curious to, you know, both hear what that self-sustaining funding source is and to see if Scott's proposal is new in any way.
In April, we probably hear governors in the past decade say, I really want to work on improving the economic climate outside of Chittenden County, because it seems like Chittenden County is doing pretty well, but there are other parts of the state that aren't. That, again, is not an easy thing to do.
Right. And so we have to wait and see what that's going to mean specifically in his economic development agenda. He did mention that idea, but we don't really know what that's going to mean yet.
Neil, we were talking earlier, the governor made it very clear yesterday that he won't support any tax increases this year, and that pledge certainly includes the statewide property tax. And right now, if no action is taken, there will be a roughly 7% increase in that statewide property tax rate.
This year, we have an even more urgent need to act, and I look forward to working with you to find solutions. Because if we don't, we face a significant statewide property tax increase. We cannot let this happen. Vermonters can't afford it. The state cannot sustain it, and I will not accept it.
So is that the $64,000 question for the upcoming budget address? How does the governor propose dealing with the funding of education without raising any tax money?
I mean, that's the great question. And look, it's great to want to work with the legislature to accomplish this very difficult task. But if that's all he's got in 3 weeks, that is really going to be a huge disappointment, not only to lawmakers, but I think to a lot of his supporters around the state. Now, he's talked about the staff-student ratio, which is sort of a third rail. We've talked a lot about school consolidation, school governance consolidation. The school governance consolidation has moved a lot in the last year, with many districts forming larger districts together. And now you start talking about physical school consolidation, where many small schools, small communities don't want to lose those schools. And it's going to take a lot of courage for the governor or anyone else to jump off the cliff and say, you know what, state of Vermont, this is really what we need to do. We need to close a bunch of small schools. We need to raise the staff-student ratio. I don't know if he's going to do it. I don't know if he's going to come up with a plan to eliminate that 9-cent tax rate that's projected, but I think a lot of people are counting on him to do that.
I mean, we're already seeing the legislature, the Democrats and the legislature building up defenses too, in preparation to push back if Scott does go ahead and propose some sort of reduction in the teacher and education staff. I mean, House Majority Leader Jill Kerwinski yesterday she seemed all primed with a talking point, calling it potentially the biggest layoff in the state. If he does try that, he's got an uphill battle.
And let's not forget, the Vermont NEA was really disappointed in Democratic leaders last year when they were sort of dancing along the collective bargaining tightrope. So the Vermont NEA is counting on finding some allies this year.
He said something I thought was interesting, which was we need to make a school system that's based on the needs of students and not nostalgia. And it's not quite clear what that means to me, but I mean, you can call it nostalgia, but I think the other aspect of that is towns' identity based on their schools, their small schools with declining enrollment. There's a lot riding on it. There's a lot of emotion tied up in schools, and if he moves to try to close some of them, I think that's going to be a really difficult emotional struggle. The other thing I wanted to say was just think back to last year. If we see a dramatic education proposal in his budget address, we may be in the same place we were last year, where schools already have their budgets basically drafted, getting ready for town meeting day. And then if there's some dramatic spending mandate coming from Montpelier, then it's going to be a strange dance to try to make all the timing work in time for this next fiscal year.
And there's really, I mean, it's a small, shallow pool to dip into in terms of finding ways to save money in the education fund. Teachers and staff are on the rise. Students are declining. And we have a lot of schools with a lot of expenses in terms of healthcare and salary and other things. So there aren't a lot of places to look here. So it's a real challenge to come up with a plan and get people to buy into that plan.
Today on the program, we have a reporters' roundtable looking at the people and issues of the 2018 legislative session. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. Let's turn to Sister Lorian in Berlin. Hi, Sister Lorian. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hello, can you hear me?
We sure can. What question do you have?
Well, I'm concerned about the Essex plan, and I'm wondering if the hope for carbon tax is absolutely hopeless.
Well, let's go around and find out. The Essex plan would be adding about a $5 per ton tax or fee or assessment, whatever we want to call it, on carbon. It's estimated to do over an eight-year period. It would raise heating oil prices and gasoline prices by 5 or 6 cents a gallon in each of those years over an eight-year period. April, what do you think about the carbon tax? Do the Democrats really want to push that this year in an election year?
It does not feel like it. Both House Speaker Mitzi Johnson and Senate President Pro Tem Tim Ash have both said that they're not anticipating that their bodies are ready to move on that plan. Mitzi Johnson said in her speech to open the session, Vermont is not an island, kind of a nod to this idea that we need to have a regional approach rather than just a state-based pricing program. And it just does not feel like the Essex plan is pretty new as well. That's the other piece. There are a lot of details that need to be worked out. And it may be a scenario where there's some discussion about it this year, and it would have to grow over a period of time so that people really feel comfortable with how that proposal would work. There would be a tax, but then there would also be some money coming back to Vermonters. And I think that there are still a lot of questions about exactly what that would look like and who would be the winners and losers.
Yeah.
And we should mention that the idea is to have a electric rebate for all Vermonters, and then Vermonters in the more rural parts of the state would get a monetary rebate every month. Neil, the idea is to have something that is revenue neutral. Mm-hmm. Does it have some political problems?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the speaker from the podium basically said no chance this year. Tim Ash, the pro tem, said, you know, if we were talking about a regional plan with our neighbors, maybe, or a national plan, maybe, but certainly not a Vermont go it alone plan. There are some issues to be worked out, even with the Essex plan, in terms of who wins, who loses in each scenario. I think there's exactly a 0% chance of seeing a carbon tax this year.
We did get this posting from John at our VPR Facebook page. I'd like to see us cut the cord between property taxes and school funding and have a more income-based system as part of the formula. I'd also like to see a statewide teacher contract so that pay and benefits are uniform across the state. Alicia, there is a bill in the Vermont Senate that basically would have everybody pay their property taxes based on their income and not the value of their property. Senator Polina, progressive from Washington County, is a big proponent of that plan. Does that plan have any chance?
You know, it's an idea that gets brought up year after year. And normally I would say, I mean, I think that would be an incredibly heavy lift to entirely restructure the way education is funded in the state. And I doubt that lawmakers have the appetite to, or the ability, frankly, to do that during 4 months. But it is interesting. I was interested to hear how Speaker Mitzi Johnson say that she wants to examine the education financing system and, see if there's a more logical way to fund education. I mean, that's, as we've established, it's a pretty fraught endeavor to undertake, especially during an election year. So I don't see a fundamental restructuring of the finance system, but I think it's possible that that concept could gain some momentum.
Let's talk to Chris in Calais. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks. So my question was actually spurred by a comment that was made by one of your panelists at the beginning of the show, saying that all those student populations in Vermont are declining, the teacher populations are increasing. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to that. Why are we hiring new teachers if there are less students?
Well, I think we should know it's not necessarily teachers. It's staff that's on the rise. And our schools are seeing a tremendous amount of new issues and problems that they haven't seen in the past with behavioral issues, disciplinary issues, learning challenges. And so we have more staff, more aides, more school workers in general, and that includes cafeteria workers, custodians, bus drivers. It's not necessarily that teachers or what we traditionally refer to as teachers are on the rise, but total staff is on the rise. And a lot of that has to do with the new brave world we face in 2018 with all of the world's challenges at our doorstep.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today we have a reporters roundtable to look at the people and issues of the new legislative session. With us today, April McCollum of the Burlington Free Press, Neil Goswami of WCAX-TV, and Alicia Freese of 7 Days. Well, last night, the House voted 81-63 to legalize the possession of small amounts of marijuana up to an ounce, and individuals could also grow 2 mature plants. Newbury Representative Chip Conquest said the time has come to legalize pot in Vermont.
Continuing to prohibit the personal use of a substance that poses little risk to public safety and less risk of harm to the user than other legal substances is antithetical to a free society which must, to remain free, have a rational justification for infringing on the freedom of its citizens.
But Arlington Representative Cynthia Browning said the vote should be delayed until there's a reliable roadside test to measure if a driver is being impaired because of marijuana use.
I want to forestall that. I want them to know that if they are pulled over, there will be a way to ascertain whether they are impaired, just as they know with alcohol.
Alicia, why did House leaders want to deal with this issue right at the start?
You know, getting back for a second to Governor Scott's State of the State, he actually made a jab at the legislature, basically criticizing them for focusing on legalizing marijuana when there are so many other important issues in play. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the reason they are taking it up so aggressively is so they can avoid that continued criticism. This is something they've debated endlessly year after year. So I think it's there's a practical reason. Let's get this out of the way and deal with more pressing financial matters. And I think there's also – there may be a political reason. I mean, this is – it's a way to kind of get it done without letting the opposition coalesce before.
And it should also be noted, this has been sitting on the House calendar for 7 months since the veto session in June. It's not like this materialized out of thin air and nobody knew it was coming. It has been sitting on the House calendar. House Republicans didn't want to suspend the rules to finish the job in June, so they knew it was coming first week of January. And I think it's sort of revisionist history to suggest that suddenly everyone's pushing this through right away. I mean, the governor even said he was prepared to sign it in June, and it just didn't come up. There wasn't enough time. So, I mean, this was on the calendar. Everybody knew it was coming. I think every outlet, news outlet in Vermont reported in the last 2 weeks, it's on the calendar. It's coming the first week. So no real surprise.
And April, what's the outlook for this bill in the Senate? And the governor has indicated he will sign it if it reaches his desk.
Well, supporters in the House were very careful to keep it narrowly tailored to the compromise that had been worked out between the House and the Senate and the governor last summer. They did not allow – there was a parade of amendments that came up from opponents and trying to add tax and regulate and all these other things. And those were all shot down, basically, so that it's very close to what was envisioned last summer. And so I don't think that there will be any surprises for the Senate. They've already approved the bill. The only change is that they have to approve. There's not going to be a commission in the bill anymore now. So I think that'll be pretty straightforward. And then on to the governor.
Now, Neil, it's interesting. Vermont, if all this passes and the governor signs it, Vermont would be the first state in the country to legalize marijuana through the legislative process. Every other state, it's been a voter referendum. And what lawmakers do is sort of work on the details of the plan that's already been approved by voters.
Right.
Do you think Vermont's experience was different because it went through the legislative process?
I'm sure it has been different because in every other state, lawmakers were forced to respond to what the voters told them they wanted. And to some extent, if you believe the polling in Vermont, a majority of Vermonters would like to see legal pot. I think the question remaining in the future is where we go from here. And whether or not the tax and regulate model is one that is embraced by more and more lawmakers. It struggled in the House in the past with, you know, very little support. And then what happens on the federal level? On the very day that Vermont House passed this bill yesterday, the Trump administration, through Attorney General Jeff Sessions, rescinded what's known as the Cole Memo, Obama-era memo that allowed states to basically legalize and operate systems in their state. But it does leave it up to U.S. attorneys in each jurisdiction to determine how they're going to approach it. And let's not forget the new U.S. attorney, Christina Nolan, was recommended by Senator Leahy and the governor, Governor Scott, and is probably less likely to go after the policies here in Vermont than maybe other states.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Yesterday, I had an opportunity to talk to Dick Sears, who's the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, also one who supports full regulatory systems in this area. But Senator Sears told me he doesn't think that Jeff Sessions' decision will have much effect in Vermont.
It shouldn't influence this bill, because this bill is really about how Vermont law enforcement would treat someone who's in possession of an ounce or less or a certain number of plants in their possession.
So, Alicia, this is the so-called personal possession approach, one that's taken in Washington, D.C., but very, very different than what's happening in Colorado and California.
Right. And it was actually interesting. I mean, we saw on the House floor Minority Leader Don Turner making a call for a full tax and regulate system. It was odd to see a Republican who's generally been opposed to the concept calling for a much more expansive proposal. And, you know, his point was we need revenue if we're going to legalize. But I think there are many proponents of marijuana legalization that are hoping that this is paving the way for that.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Mary in Windsor. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me. My question is, I would like, in the spirit of transparency, to know how many legislators in the House actually smoke marijuana or use pot, so that we could find out if, in fact, this is a self-motivated rather than a statewide referendum of sorts, and find out, in fact, if you put it to the public in the state of Vermont, would those people who want this actually show up to vote?
April, do you have any idea of How many lawmakers use marijuana?
I have not conducted a survey. It does kind of come up kind of as a wink, wink, nudge, nudge sometimes that some lawmakers have used marijuana in their pasts. It came up on the House floor yesterday. I think someone asked how many joints you could roll with a certain amount of marijuana. And then one of the lawmakers was like, well, I can tell you it's a lot, kind of as an indication that he had some personal experience. But I don't know if it's a broad number of people who would use it if it were legal.
No, I mean, look at the makeup of the legislature. It's generally older, probably fewer lawmakers actually use marijuana than the national average, I would say. But who knows? And I don't know. I don't get the sense that anyone's approaching this as a personal sort of gain. It's more of a – for many people, it's a criminal justice issue. It's a safety and enforcement issue and many other factors other than they just want to go home and smoke pot.
Yeah, I agree with Neil. I mean, lawmakers have been known in the past to pursue self-serving legislation, but I think in this case they are following what they believe is the will of the people.
And, you know, Alicia, I think the most recent poll that I saw of how Vermonters feel about legalizing marijuana, it's about 60 or 65% who are in favor of legalizing marijuana. But they really split on the question of personal possession versus retail outlets and the taxation, almost right down the middle. And we certainly saw this last year in the vote in the House that really went against the tax and regulate plan of the Senate. So it's hard to know exactly where a majority of Vermonters stand on this issue.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't seen that, but that is probably another reason why it's been it's proven so challenging for proponents to push this legalization and regulation idea.
Let's talk to Nancy, who has a question on the marijuana issue. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. How you doing today?
Great.
I just wanted to know how me, as a regular little old Vermonter, could get into the business that I feel our legislatures are kind of locking the little people out. I would like to become a craft producer of cannabis, just like the state has maple syrup, craft beer, all sorts of amazing products. Cannabis should be one of them. And I'll take my answer off the air, but I just want to make sure that the legislature understands that we need to be part of the answer, not to be shunned and pushed away. Also, one other thing, when your legislatures are written to and they do not respond to you because your opinion is different than theirs, I find it highly offensive, and there's one woman in particular that is a screaming banshee that does not respond to me from last year or this year, and I think it's time for everybody to get up and speak out.
Okay, Nancy, we'll see if we can get an answer for you. It's very interesting, Neil. This was an issue that sunk the voter referendum on marijuana legalization in Ohio last year. It came down to who would be allowed to grow marijuana if it was legalized. Mm-hmm. And in Ohio, the referendum really cut out the local growers that Nancy is talking about. And so people who got opposed to that said this is a corporate weed bill. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is one of the kinds of questions that will have to come up in a tax and regulate plan.
Absolutely. And to be clear, in the version approved by the House yesterday, nobody can grow it other than the small amount at home that you can do. There is no commercial growing allowed or selling allowed. So that would prohibit the sort of – I don't know what – if she's producing an edible or some other type of product that she wants to produce and sell, but that wouldn't be allowed under the current version. Now, if we move to a tax and regulate model, those are really that's a heavy debate that lawmakers are going to have. Who can produce things? Who can grow things? Where can you sell it? What are the permits like? You know, who is allowed to enter this new market? That debate will happen. I hope people like Nancy will be able to participate in that and provide testimony to lawmakers. I think it's important that they hear those opinions from people who want to be involved in whatever market or future there is. That remains to be seen whether we get there or not.
Let's talk to Irv in Norwich. Hey, Irv, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I listened carefully to the governor's address, and when he talked about the loss of youthful population in all parts of the state except the Burlington area, he's right on the mark, but I was surprised when he talked about the need to retain and recruit more young people. He didn't say a word about infrastructure, either transportation or broadband. And the lack of broadband infrastructure in rural areas is one of the reasons we're losing people.
That's a very good point. Alicia, do you think that's something the governor might address in his budget speech?
It's certainly possible. I mean, he did make a plug for focusing on rural Vermont and really putting the legislature's attentions there. And I think it's hard to deny that broadband remains insufficient in parts of Vermont. So it's possible.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today, a reporter's roundtable to look at the issues of the 2018 legislative session. With us today, Neil Goswami of WCAX-TV, Alicia Freese of 7 Days, and April McCollum of the Burlington Free Press. As we've been talking today, the governor says no tax increases, no fee increases. That could be a problem with water quality issues. Some lawmakers want to have a sustainable funding source to help clean up Lake Champlain and other lakes in Vermont. Senate Natural Resources Chairman Chris Bray has proposed a $1 per month fee on all land parcels in Vermont. This would amount to $12 a year for all landowners. He says it's a fair approach because water quality affects everyone in the state.
We're really talking a very modest investment, but given that water, clean water, is essential to everyone, I think it is reasonable and responsible of us to say, everybody in, everybody pays.
But Natural Resources Secretary Julie Moore says this fee would be expensive to administer and is not the right approach.
And we found that the administrative costs were high. In fact, they were disproportionate to the amount of revenue raised. And the working group concluded that other options need to be evaluated to try and achieve that goal of something that is both environmentally efficient and cost effective.
April, this feels like it's going to be a big issue this year. Up until this point, the Scott administration has been using the capital bill to use bonding money to help clean up Lake Champlain and other waterways. But there are some people who want to have a more long-term, sustainable funding source for this, and that's going to run head into the Scott administration.
Yes. So they've been using capital funding, and right now they're proposing to continue that reliance. The other source of funding currently is a surcharge on the property transfer tax. So for people who are doing real estate transactions, it's a kind of a small group compared to, you know, I was thinking about this per parcel field. The argument for the per parcel field is that it's everybody. When they passed the Clean Water Bill a couple years ago, all the lawmakers were walking around with buttons that said all in. And that's always been the theme of the Clean Water Bill. And the difficulty is trying to figure out how to make that happen. The Scott administration is not wanting to look like they're raising property taxes, even if you call it a fee. They don't want that impression. They don't want it on people's property tax bill, which is one of the reasons they say it would be so costly in terms of administration, because they would separate it out onto a different mechanism separate from the property tax. So it will be controversial because lawmakers want to see a funding source. They don't want to keep on pushing this down the road and keep on putting it on the debt service for the state.
Sorry, go ahead, Alicia.
Thanks. I think the per parcel fee will face some opposition within the legislature as well, because, you know, you can make the argument that everybody needs clean water, but you can also make the argument that not everybody has contributed equally to dirtying the water, and therefore should, you know, perhaps the farms that have contributed a large portion of the pollution should take a larger role. That, of course, it can be a very unpopular endeavor as well. So there's not been a realistic alternative that I've seen, but I think that per parcel fee is going to be controversial.
And the governor in his speech said, I know we need a long-term revenue source, but the position seems to be just not yet. And the problem with that, if you're Tim Ash or you're a lot of other lawmakers, is that then you use the capital bill. And for Tim Ash, that bonding capacity is needed for mental health beds and other infrastructure needs that the state has. And if you throw clean water initiatives into it, then you're taking away from these much needed improvements elsewhere. So it's a problem. It's a showdown in the making. At the end of the session, we might come back and be talking about how the governor vetoed some, you know, tax or fee for clean water.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to John from Stratford. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Bob. I think the reality is that Vermont is a very progressive state, but it's a very high tax state. We have a high income tax, a high sales tax, and high property taxes. I think the challenge that we face, and we have over the years, a lot of good programs, a lot of good schools. I think we're at the point where we are taxed enough, and what we have to do is start making hard choices regarding the programs we have and improving the programs we have. And I would cite in particular the preschool bill that was passed a few years ago that has real problems in its implementation. And I would really urge legislators of both parties to focus on how we can make the laws that we have passed work better, find more efficiencies, rather than at this in existing programs, rather than passing new sweeping legislation, and really concentrate this year on making our government work better.
John, thanks very much for your phone call. April, Neil mentioned mental health issues. There are some lawmakers who feel like this is a very, very big issue for the 2018 session. In what way? What will be the key elements of that debate?
Well, the key symptom of the problem that people are most concerned about is people waiting in emergency departments and hospitals for days because there's nowhere else for them to go to get treatment. And by the way, we have some data on that, and we can see that people are waiting days, but the data is only for involuntary treatment. And so we don't know how many people are voluntarily going and can't get treatment in those kind of settings. So that's a crisis. It's been described as such by the Secretary of Human Services, Al Gobay. And last year, lawmakers and the administration agreed to kind of stake out their positions and figure out what was going on. And the administration is coming back with some reports about what might be done on that front. I haven't seen a lot of clarity about specific action steps yet, but I know that that is something that both the administration and lawmakers really want to prioritize in terms of maybe having some more beds for specific populations or building new facilities.
We didn't hear anything about that in Scott's speech, which I thought was interesting. And I think, you know, while there isn't consensus yet on what precisely needs to be done, there is a growing feeling that the state does need to invest in new facilities specifically for people who might otherwise be at a nursing home or people who would otherwise be in prison. And those neither of those would be cheap to build and to maintain.
Neil, different subject. Senate President Tim Ash has identified raising the state minimum wage to $15 an hour as one of his top priorities for this session. He says he really wants this to happen. What's the outlook for this bill?
I think you're probably going to see it get through the Senate and the House, although the House is less into raising the minimum wage than they are about passing paid family leave. But if you are the Democratic Party, it really helps you, you know, rally your base in an election year if you put something like that on the governor's desk and force him to veto it, which ironically might really rally his base at the same time. So I think we're likely to see a bill pass. I don't think the governor is going to support that. And it's interesting to hear Tim Ash, Senator Ash, talk about the affordability issue, because he's sort of co-opting the governor's message and saying, yeah, we want to talk about affordability, but affordability is beyond what the governor is talking about. It's about lifting low and middle income Vermonters and placing them into an economic spectrum that they can operate in, you know, and be comfortable in. So I think it's going to go somewhere.
And Alicia, on the House side, House Speaker Mitzi Johnson thinks that paid family leave bill, which passed the House last year, is an absolute top priority. Senate President Tim Ash says he's certainly willing to look at it. It's not as high a priority for him as raising the minimum wage. But this is another area where the governor is saying no way, no how.
Right. I mean, and he makes the argument that both proposals will put further pressure on businesses, and in particular small businesses. It's interesting that we're seeing the exact same situation repeat itself, where you've got the House pushing one, you know, what it says is a really important economic development and affordability mechanism, and the Senate has a very different idea of what the best way of going about it is. And you know, they're both advocating for the each proposal, and neither is willing, of course, to come out and say, no, I don't support increasing the minimum wage. No, I don't support paid family leave. But I don't know if they're going to be able to work out their differences.
Well, you can also see a plausible path forward where they look at each other and grudgingly accept each other's, and you get both in an election year. So we'll see.
I know, April, you know, sometimes what I'm picking up at the State House is it's going to be one bill or the other that passes. Do you have a sense that are you picking that up as well?
I think these two bills are often linked in discussion, but I don't know that they have to be one or the other, because the paid family leave, the way it's set up right now, it's not a huge tax on payroll for employees. And it's only on employees, so there wouldn't necessarily be as much of an impact on businesses as, for example, the minimum wage bill. They're looking at a little bit different issues. And I think it's possible we could see them both pass. The House Speaker, in her opening speech, mentioned a decent wage as one of the things that she thought was really important. Income inequality is really important to her. So we'll see.
Neil, one other question is the whole budget process, and we're going to have the governor's budget speech in about 2 weeks. But we don't have a budget from Washington yet. There's a continuing budget resolution that expires on January 22nd. We don't know if Congress is going to make changes to Medicaid or other programs. How does the Vermont Appropriations Committees in the House and the Senate deal with this uncertainty?
Well, I think it's just like last year. Every year we seem to enter the legislative session where they're worried about what Washington is going to do. And the speaker made some reference to that this week, basically saying last year it felt like we were just sitting around and waiting, and it doesn't sound like she's willing to do that anymore. They're going to march forward with their own agendas. But we should note that Washington could dictate a lot of what happens here in Vermont. If they don't fully fund the CHIP program, the state's on the hook next year in 2019 for a lot – 21 more – million more.
The CHIP program being
the Children's Health Insurance Program. And they could cut other environmental programs or other things that we're relying on that the state would have to really dig deep for, which then would put the governor's no tax, no fee thing really in jeopardy.
It's going to be fascinating to see how the legislature deals with all these issues. That's our program for today. Many thanks to our panel, April McCollum of the Burlington Free Press, Alicia Freese of 7 Days, and Neil Goswami of WCAX-TV. Thank you all very much for a great program.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
Thank you.